you know, it's extremely dangerous. And you're also, you know, that if you can save this whale, it actually is contributing, you know, potentially to the species. I mean, with only 375 whales and only about 100 breeding females, every animal is really important.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound, conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South influences who they are and what they do. It's summer, so today we're talking about the ocean. To be specific, we're talking about whales and other marine creatures with my guest, Clay George. George is a wildlife biologist with the Georgia Department of Natural Resources. He's based in my hometown of Brunswick, Georgia. Garden and Gun named him one of their southern heroes for the work he's done as part of a team to keep the North Atlantic right whale from going extinct. He helps track the whales when they come south to give birth in the wintertime, and also does the delicate and dangerous work of disentanglement, cutting the whales loose from commercial fishing lines. The whales he's helped save include an incredibly tough whale named Ruffian. Clay tells us about Ruffian and about manatees and about the issues our southern marine animals face, including the massive one that is already changing the coast, climate change. Here's my conversation with Clay George. The other night, we saw a documentary, my family and I, called The Year Earth Changed. And it was about how the pandemic was bad for humans, but good for a lot of animals, because there was more access to breeding grounds and there were just not as many people around to get in the way of the things that animals normally do and would like to do. And I'm wondering if that was your experience from what you saw over the last year, whether there were differences in marine life now that people weren't so much around.
Not so much here, I would say. You know, one of the things we saw is that when, you know, people were, you know, couldn't go to restaurants or go on their normal vacations and the like, they were getting outside and recreating, you know? And so we saw, you know, just, you know, I don't have any stats on it, but I just, you know, I saw a lot more people boating and fishing and out and enjoying the outdoors, which is a good thing. We're going to talk about right whales, I'm sure, at some point here. There's some indication that, you know, the global shipping slowed down a bit. And that, you know, that's a big factor from ship strikes are a big mortality factor for that species. There's also some indication that, you know, them certain types of fishery exports like lobster declined because of, you know, difficulties with exporting things, and entanglement in fishing rope is a real problem. The biggest problem affecting right whales right now. So it's, you know, maybe a mixed bag, you know, in a way.
You mentioned right whales. I think that is, when you Google your name, that's kind of the first thing that comes up, stories about that and that sort of thing. Could you kind of explain for people who might not know about right whales, sort of their story, how they got to this kind of place in their history, and what people like you are doing to try to preserve them?
Sure. Well, first, I think, it's important to kind of say what they are. You know, I think people have a general idea from TV what a whale is, but when you see these things out in the wild, it's really impressive. They're 40 feet long when they're full grown. They weigh up to 40-50 tons. To put that in context, that's like the 4,000 20 pound watermelons. You know, I mean, it's an enormous animal. You know, they've got this mouth that's full of these baleen plates where they can open their mouth and plow through the water and filter feed for plankton. For whatever reason, they come down here to the Georgia coast to have their calves. But, you know, really the story of the North Atlantic right whale goes back centuries, and that's because of whaling. And, you know, this was the species that, early whalers, you know, cut their teeth on, if you will, because they live close to shore and they're pretty slow and they've got a lot of fat, and the baleen used to be useful before there were things like plastics. And they were basically almost driven to extinction, very close. We think there were probably as few as 100 left in the entire North Atlantic by the turn of the 20th century. In fact, there were so few that whalers didn't even bother really targeting them anymore. And they were one of the first species that gained international protection. But if you flash forward, to the late 20th century, the interesting thing is that, most scientists weren't really paying attention to them. There were very few sightings in the Atlantic, and a lot of people thought they were essentially functionally extinct. And then in the late 70s and early 80s, this whole series of kind of accidental events happened that pointed scientists to the fact that these animals were still out there and they were aggregating in certain locations and they could be protected.
I want to stop you right there. What do you mean by accidental events?
Yeah. So in the Northeast, there were scientists that were doing work on other things and they stumbled across these feeding aggregations in the Gulf of Maine. So that's basically the area between, Massachusetts and Cape Cod and Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, Canada. And so they found, these aggregations of animals socializing and feeding in the Gulf of Maine. We're talking dozens of animals. And so dozens of right whales at that time was really something special. And then if you come down here to the Southeast, the story's even a bit crazier because these animals are calving literally, 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 miles off the beach. They were right here in our backyards, and it was really completely unknown to science.
So they come down south basically in the winter to have their children, basically, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, whales are feeding in the Northeast year round on plankton. The females that get pregnant will make this, 1,000-plus mile migration down the coast. We think it's because the waters here are pretty shallow and protected from the big winter storms that you have up north. The temperature seems to be right for calving. And also there's not, we don't have killer whales or large amounts of white sharks and such. And so it seemed like it's just a good place for them. It's very similar to the types of habitat they calve in. The other species of right whales calve in the Southern Hemisphere. And so, back in 79, some DNR biologists, Georgia Department of Natural Resources biologists, the agency I work for, were out doing some work offshore on artificial reefs, and they saw this right whale with a calf, and they took photographs of it. And they thought, wow, that's pretty neat. We know these things are pretty scarce. And then a couple of years later, some newborn calves washed up dead on a couple Georgia Barrier Islands. And then the word, finally got back to the folks up in New England at the New England Aquarium in Boston, who had been doing this work up north. And their interest was really piqued. And so they partnered with this fellow named Dave Mattingly, who is a retired Delta airline pilot. And at the time he was flying for Delta, and he had friends that had planes, and they got together with these New England Aquarium folks and flew some surveys off the Georgia coast in 1984. And lo and behold, they see, mother and calf right whales out there. And so here, these 40 ton animals had been right here in our backyard for probably centuries. And it just had escaped detection.
And part of your involvement now is to track these, right? How do y'all keep track of? I noticed as I was looking on various websites and things looking at this, that not only do the whales have numbers, but a lot of them have names that people have given them over the years. How do y'all keep track of their movements and that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So every right whale, when it gets to be about a year old, will have developed these white patches on their heads. And those patches are unique to that animal. It's essentially like a fingerprint. And so we go out either in boats or aircraft, and we take photographs of every whale we see. There's a catalog online. People can go look it up. It's called the North Atlantic Right Whale Catalog. And at this point, we think there are about 375 or so right whales alive. And we know that because we're going out and getting photographs of them. Our colleagues down in Florida are going out and getting photographs of them. People in New England and Canada are doing the same. And so all of that data gets shared and in input into this single catalog that we all work from. And like you said, they all have these 4-digit codes that are based on, the year that they get added to the catalog, which is often their roughly, their age, if you will, it corresponds with their age. And then some, to make it easier, because, people like me that I have a hard time keeping up with, 3810 versus 3180. And so over time, some of them will get, names and which just helps us, those of us in the field, but probably helps, kind of make a connection with maybe the public as well. And when you take years and years and decades of data, and the data go back to the 80s, you can basically use, certain types of statistics to estimate how many there are and how, what their survival rates are and the trajectory of the population.
So I know a part of that job of tracking and taking care of these whales is, I guess, what y'all call disentanglement, right? Which is getting them, whales who've been caught up in fishing lines or that sort of thing, nets maybe, to get them out of that. Have you done a lot of that work?
Yeah, I wouldn't say a lot, but a lot compared to the average person, we see about one entangled right whale here in the Southeast per winter. These are typically animals that are becoming entangled in, heavy rope that's used in fisheries like the lobster fishery and the snow crab fishery. And they're most of the time, we think, they're swimming down here from the Northeast in Canada. And sometimes it's really simple, like a piece of rope through their mouth coming out each side. And you can, maybe sometimes we don't even need to do anything. Maybe sometimes we know over time they'll just shed that on their own. But other times they can become really badly entangled, and the rope can become embedded in their bodies and around their flippers and in their mouth. And basically they're goners if somebody doesn't happen across them and disentangle them. Because, right whales don't have fingers, right? So if they get entangled, it's not like they can just, pull the rope out like you or I would. The thing that makes this really challenging is, well, firstly, they're in the ocean, right? And so we've got to do all this work from boats. You got to find them. You got to get lucky enough to find them to start with. And they can go down and they can dive and stay below surface for many minutes at a time, which makes it hard to follow them. But the biggest problem is they don't seem to understand that we're trying to help them when we're out there doing this. And so they are typically very evasive and try their best to swim away from us. We can't get in the water to work on them because it would be extremely dangerous to do that. So everything we're doing is with, knives on poles and other types of specialized equipment from the side of a boat while we follow behind them. And it's all, certainly the most surreal thing that we do here at out of this office as biologists, because, it's extremely dangerous. And you're also, that if you can save this whale, it actually is contributing, potentially to the species. I mean, with only 375 whales and only about 100 breeding females, every animal is really important.
So have you had instances where you've gone out and encountered a whale that you knew their name, or basically the name that y'all had given it, that you had made some sort of connection with it before? Like when you got out there, you're like, oh, that's, whoever.
Yeah, no, for sure. There's certain ones that are scarred to the point where they're immediately, recognizable. And probably the best example is this right whale that is nicknamed Ruffian. We saw him down here in the 2000s, just covered in these horrible wounds. We don't know what he got entangled in, possibly metal cable from maybe a trawler or something. And it had literally scraped, 3-foot sections of blubber off of his body. He was, I just assumed that he was a goner at that point, just seeing him from a boat. But then, a year later, he shows up back down here and he looks pretty good, except all that, those areas were now white from scarring. Normally right whales are black in most areas. And so he would come back every year and you get to know him and it's like, oh, there's Ruffian. And then in 2017, I think it was, Ruffian showed up down here, badly entangled in rope. Our partners at the Clearwater Marine Aquarium Research Institute, who fly our aerial surveys, spotted him, and we were able to get, boat offshore and arrive right before sunset and get a tracking buoy on him. And, which, if we hadn't been able to do that, the odds of us finding him again would have been very small. And then the next day we got together with some of our colleagues at Florida Fish and Wildlife and took a few boats out there and some tools and such, and spent an hour or two, literally chasing this whale around in the ocean with knives. And we're able to get a special kind of cutting knife and on this really heavy rope. When I say heavy, I'm talking, 5/8 inch diameter, poly rope. It's really like 10,000 pound breaking strength type stuff. And if we got really lucky, it popped it loose and it basically all the rope came off and he, you know, swam out off and away. And then the crazy part is, you know, we go to start recovering the rope and gear because we want to always figure out what these animals are becoming entangled and what kind of gear it is. And here this whale had basically been dragging a 100+ pound, 6-foot diameter steel snow crab pot all the way from Canada.
Oh my God.
And you could actually see where along a third of the hoop of the pot where it was rubbed shiny from him dragging it that distance. And, you know, he would be dead now, you know, likely if we hadn't just happened to find him and were able to help give him a hand, you know?
So he had dragged that pot like what, 1,000 miles?
Yeah. If it was from the Gulf of St. Lawrence, which is really kind of one of the key areas up there where there's a lot of snow crab fishing, where the right whales go now. Yeah. You're talking possibly 1500 miles. So.
Oh man. So when y'all have these repeated encounters with whales, do you notice any difference? Like you talked about them being evasive. If you're approaching one for the third or fourth time or something, do you get any sense that they have any idea that you might be, you know, nice people there to help or something like that?
Not really. and you know, right whales are, you know, they're amazing animals, but I wouldn't say that they're the smartest animals out there. You know, they're big oceanic grazers. They're basically like huge, enormous cows out in the ocean, swimming around grazing on plankton. And most of the time when, thankfully, the whales that we're seeing out there are normal, healthy moms with calves, you know, swimming next to them. And they spend a lot of time just kind of laying around down here because they're not feeding in the Southeast. They're just hanging out for the winter and, you know, having their calves and nursing them and teaching their calves how to swim before they'll migrate back north. And like any wild animal, it kind of depends on the day. Sometimes you'll boat up to get your photographs and they'll be incredibly evasive. And if you see that same whale a month later, it might just sit there and let you boat around it in circles. You know, the latter type of behavior, you know, it's probably one of the reasons these animals were so easily hunted by, you know, early whalers. They'll often just what we call log at the surface, like a big log, and rest, you know, for minutes at a time. Yeah, but it's still really amazing to see. I don't want to make it sound like it's not a cool sight, because you're out there in the ocean and oftentimes you can't see any land in any, you know, back behind you. It's just flat calm some days. And these 40-ton animals are sitting out there with this calf playing around and rolling around on their back. And then when you think about the fact that they were so close to being snuffed out and they somehow clung to it and they're still out there, it's, you know, a miracle of sorts.
When we come back, I talk to Clay George about how climate change is affecting not just marine life on the coast, but human life too.
You know, historically, you might see some of these flooding events when there was, say, a tropical storm or really like a nor'easter, you know, really strong winds that would kind of push the water in. But now we're seeing sometimes, you know, parking lots and roads flooded, you know, on sunny days when it's, you know, there's really hardly any breeze.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to the interview today, I'd just like to take a quick moment to say thanks. We're closing in on 100 episodes of this little old podcast, and we're still going strong because of you, the listeners. I've had so many people tell me that Southbound has become a regular part of their lives, which is incredibly gratifying to hear. A few of you have told me you dove into the Southbound archives to get you through the pandemic, and that makes my day every time I hear it. Our goal is pretty simple, to keep making this podcast and to keep making it better. I'm always glad to hear your thoughts and ideas. Email me anytime at ttomlinson@wfae.org. And now, back to my conversation with Clay George. I'm wondering what else you've seen out there. Like, you know, this would be a sort of bucket list moment for many of us to see these whales, but you see them all the time. Have you gone out and had an experience where there was... you really saw something you didn't expect or that you came back telling other people about?
Yeah. So we do see white sharks offshore, which is We don't know if that's really a new thing or if we just started noticing them, kind of like the right whales got noticed, you know, in the 80s. But now that the aerial survey teams have, you know, digital cameras, for instance, they were able to start getting these photographs of white sharks. Oftentimes, you know, ironically enough, feeding on carcasses of dead whales that might be seen. And now there are researchers that have been doing tagging work on white sharks down here.
You mentioned earlier that you guys work on things to prevent things like entanglements from happening in the first place. How do you do that?
Yeah, so that's where it gets tough. Rope entanglement has been an ongoing issue for really as long as people have been studying right whales, since the 80s. And unfortunately, it's getting worse and worse and worse. At this point, 80% of all the animals have scars from having been entangled at least once. About 60% have been entangled twice. You know, a good chunk of animals are getting entangled every year. Thankfully, most of those are minor, and we never even see the rope on them. You just see the scars that are left. But a small number of animals are in every given year are getting entangled badly, and they can die acutely by just drowning in heavy gear, or they can drag it around for sometimes months or even years. And then they will die from, you know, the drag and the inability to feed and infection from the cuts and such. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that, you know, if these animals were, you know, on our city streets entangled and had the wounds like I've seen on these animals from this rope, that people would demand that something was done about it. It's a classic example of out of sight, out of mind. Well, with that said, the feds, the folks at NOAA Fisheries and state agencies and fishermen and others have been trying to address the issue for many years. And it's a tough one, because at this point, the only way you can catch lobster, for instance, or snow crab, is you put basically a fisherman drops a trap or pot down to the ocean floor. And there has to be rope in the water column attached to a buoy so that they can come back and, you know, pull that trap back up and, you know, pull the lobster or crab out and put new bait in. Now, one thing that could happen that is on the horizon that all of us are really hopeful could be a game changer is this idea of what's called ropeless gear. And so the idea is that, you know, you would keep the rope like coiled up down on the floor on the ocean floor with the pots where it's out of the way and where the whales can't get entangled in it. And then when the fisherman wants to, you know, check their pots, they basically can use an acoustic signal to release the buoy and it pops up. And there's other kinds of systems that don't even use rope at all. And this is being done in some fisheries in other countries. There are fishermen that are testing it here in the U.S., but it's, you know, it's expensive compared to the way they fish now. And so I think it's going to require a lot of investment in testing and research to pull it off on a, you know, fishery, say the scale of the lobster fishery. To give you a sense of that scale, I mean, in the Northeast U.S., there's at any time there's hundreds of thousands of these buoy lines that are deployed and left out in the environment. And, you know, the whales are out there swimming around with their mouths agape feeding, and they can just, unfortunately, they get, you know, get entangled in this stuff.
So as I was doing research for this, I noticed that you had done some work rescuing manatees. And which surprised me, because I grew up, you know, where you were at in Brunswick, coastal Georgia. I don't think I ever saw a manatee there when I was growing up there 30, 35 years ago. Is that an issue where they've sort of migrated north over the past few years, or were they there all along and I just didn't see them?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. For one thing, anyone who's been down here knows that in most places the water here in Georgia is pretty murky. There's a lot of nutrients in the water because of our marsh ecosystems, and so it's just hard to see them. You know, even those of us who do research on manatees, you know, it's difficult to do certain types of work like aerial surveys, because it's just so hard to see them. You know, that you can only see them when they come right up to the surface. So that's one issue. We know they've always been here. There's, you know, there were records from, you know, the early 20th century even. But the population of manatees has increased in Florida. And so I think probably a lot of it is just that there's more animals in Florida. And so there's more opportunities for, you know, the the animals that happen to want to migrate, there's just more of them that available to come up here during the summer months. But yeah, it's like in our work, pretty much it's either manatee season or it's right whale season. You know, the right whales show up in late November. They're here through the winter and into late March. And then by that point, the water temperature starts to rise. They head back north, and then the manatees are kind of coming out of Florida.
Yeah, I was wondering whether there was an animal that was sort of the canary in the coal mine for you guys, like something, a particular species or something you look at to say, you know, if these animals are struggling or in trouble, that's a bad sign for everything else.
At a kind of ocean scale level, not to go back to right whales and harp on them, but they really are, they are a canary in the coal mine. And one of the reasons that we've seen this increase in mortality in the last 10 years and a decrease in calving is because the population has shifted from the Gulf of Maine ecosystem during the summer months and where they used to feed, to up to the Gulf of St. Lawrence in Canada, where they go now, many of the animals go now to feed. And the problem with that is that when they first started going up there in big numbers and after 2010, there weren't protections in place in Canadian waters. Like there weren't ship speed zones and there weren't seasonal closed areas for, you know, for snow crab, for instance. And so a number of animals died during, in fact, about 30 were found dead from 2017 to 2019, mostly in Canada. And so why is that happening? You know, initially we didn't, no one knew, but now it's becoming clearer that the water temperatures in the Gulf of Maine are increasing and the food that the right whales depend on, this type of zooplankton called, it's a copepod, which is like a tiny crustacean. They basically don't exist at this in the same densities like they used to. And the right whales have basically been having to go farther north to find food. And at the same time, it seemed like females weren't getting enough food to get, you know, put on the fat reserves they need to calve normally. And so not only did we see this increase in mortality, but we saw calving rates fall by half. And it doesn't, you know, take a rocket scientist to know that if, you know, the number of animals that are dying goes up and the number that are being born declines, you're going to see a decline in the population. And so that's exactly what's happened. From about 2010, the species went from about 480 animals to only about 375 today, a decade later. And they're continuing to decline. And the species is really at a crossroads. We really know why they're declining. And we have to decide if we're going to take the big steps to help them. The good news is that all the models suggest that if we can reduce the amount that are dying from human causes, that even during periods of low calving, the species can persist and their trajectory can stabilize. So it's not a lost cause.
Part of what it sounds like you're talking about is climate change. And as we've learned more about climate change, I think the place where we first expect to see things happen is on the coast. Obviously, in some places, the coast is already shrinking. What have you noticed in your work about how the places where you work and live have changed because of climate change?
Yeah, probably the most noticeable thing here for those of us that live, you know, on the coast is that we're seeing what's called sunny day flooding. And, you know, we have these big tides in coastal Georgia, you know, 7 to 8 foot feet twice a day, back and forth. And we also get bigger tides, you know, during certain moon phases during the spring and fall. They're called king tides. And these can be, you know, 10 and 11 foot tides. And so normally, you know, historically, you might see some of these flooding events when there was, say, a tropical storm or really like a nor'easter, you know, really strong winds that would kind of push the water. But now we're seeing sometimes, you know, parking lots and roads flooded, you know, on sunny days when it's, you know, there's really hardly any breeze. And the data bear that out, you know, the average, height is increasing. So, if there's one kind of silver lining to that here in coastal Georgia, it's that, you know, so much of our marshes are protected. You know, there's, I think it's 300 something thousand acres of marsh here in coastal Georgia, all of which is protected by state law. And the models suggest, at least over the next century, as the sea level increases, that there should be enough accretion of sediment and also area for the marsh to migrate inland that will continue to have, you know, healthy marsh. But if people do things like put up seawalls or harden the shoreline, you know, so that the marsh can't move, then that won't happen. From what I gather, I'm not an expert on that area, so I don't want to, you know, speculate too much more. But beyond a century from now, that's when, you know, it becomes much more questionable.
How did you get into this work in the first place?
Well, I mean, the shortest answer would be my father. You know, he grew up on a farm in East Texas, and I was the youngest of the three kids. And, you know, but his older brothers grew up and moved on, and he spent a lot of time by himself walking and, you know, on the farm and hunting and fishing. And when we came along, we ended up moving to North Carolina. You know, he was the kind of dad that, you know, by the time I was 6, 7 years old, I knew the names of all the common plants and the birds. And we were, you know, we went fishing all the time. And he just, you know, saw to it that even though I was kind of the first generation removed from the farm, you know, he wanted us to, me and my brother, to understand nature and, you know, respect the land and you know, kind of get that, you know. And so I grew up, you know, always loving being outdoors and the like. But when I went to college, I ended up double majoring in biology and English and didn't really have any kind of master plan, so to speak. But I remember I got an offer to job right out of college, and it was working for a trade publication or something of that sort, and it paid well, and it was in Raleigh. And I went fishing that weekend. They told me I could think about it and get back to them on Monday. And I was like, you know, I just want to do something like this. You know, I've worked really hard in school to, why not try to do something where I could enjoy, you know, get some personal enjoyment out of it, but also contribute and kind of give back. And that's when I started looking at graduate school programs, and I ended up getting into University of Georgia and got this amazing project working on, oyster catchers, which are a type of shorebird. And so spent a couple summers on the Georgia coast boating around and counting shorebirds and checking nests and you know, I was hooked. I mean, the Georgia coast is just such a beautiful place. It was unlike anything I had ever seen.
I know we've talked a lot in this discussion about bad things, you know, scarred up whales and dead animals and manatees that need to be rescued and all that sort of thing. Are you able in your job? Do you have times when you can see the beauty of it a little more clearly?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, because, you know, like anybody, when you're doing your work, you get a bit desensitized to it, and you know, there's a lot of routine. And I don't want people to think that when you're a wildlife biologist, you spend every day in a boat, you know, having fun, like looking at right whales or manatees. We spend a lot of time in the office, you know, doing administrative stuff and, you know, writing grant proposals and writing reports and things of that nature. But there are days when we're out working where you do have a minute to look around and appreciate it. And I tell you, the one that gets me the most is when we've been offshore, you know, working all day, trying to find whales. And sometimes, you know, a lot of times we get skunked. I mean, they're, you know, they're endangered. There's not a ton of them out there. And it'll be cold in wintertime, and you're coming back into shore, and you get inside a land. And as you're coming into, like, say, Sapelo Sound between St. Catharines Island and Blackbeard Island, you can look in every direction as you come into that sound, and you can't see anything that humans have built. It's just undisturbed beach and dunes and maritime forest with the live oaks. And as you boat into the sound, you know, you start smelling the pines. And which you don't notice that smell when you're here on land all the time. It takes getting away from it, you know, for a little bit to appreciate it. And yeah, there are definitely times like that where, you know, you get a chance to look around and realize how fortunate you are.
The right whale got its name because it was so easy to kill that it was the right one for whalers to go after. They went after him all right, to the point where there were maybe fewer than 100 North Atlantic right whales left. Even with 40 years of conservation and the hard work of people like Clay George, the population is still in the low 3 digits. You could make a case, I guess, that it's not worth the trouble to save them. To really preserve marine life requires people to change, to make the fishing industry not so dependent on lines, to change routes for giant cargo ships, and most of all, to make consumers not so demanding for the things that come to us via the sea. But even if we don't want to change, the planet changes around us. People like Clay George see it happening around the edges. The way the environment is changing for the whale, the manatee, the sea turtle, those changes are coming for us. There was a time, maybe still is, when save the whales was used as a mocking phrase to make fun of people who want to take care of our Earth. But it's not just about saving the whales anymore. It's about saving ourselves. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.